welcome along to this week's episode of the Let's Get Running podcast. Thanks to all those that listened in last week and the lovely feedback we had. It's nice. I'm running. I'm out and about in Amsterdam, running through the industrial estate, recording this show. If you did enjoy last week's show, I got some lovely emails from it. That's really nice. Thank you very much. It's really lovely if you could, if you've got time, to leave us a review. That does help us publicise the show. I get more listeners and I can justify to my wife why I continue to spend many hours recording and editing this show. So that would be fantastic. Thanks very much. Now, this week's episode is my first attempt at running an interview, and I'm going to be interviewing somebody remotely on Zoom. So she'll be running elsewhere and I'm running here. And the person I'm interviewing, well, basically, I was contacted by a chap called Jerry Lockspear, who is a journalist, I believe, and an author. And he and his colleague, Andrew Roberts, have written a book called Running Stories. That's taking stories from runners of all types, of people, of abilities, of backgrounds, and put them together in a book. I recommend you check that out. He mentioned a really interesting story from Jerry Carey, and Jerry, who we are going to be talking to very shortly. Thanks very much for listening, and I'll see you again, hopefully next week. Bye bye. So welcome along, listeners. We are talking today to Jerry Carey. How are you doing, Jerry?
Hi, I'm well, thank you. How are you?
I'm very well.
I guess we should start by asking, so where are you running? Whereabouts have you decided to take this interview?
I am in King's Meadow Park, not far from my house. Very smart, but the closest greenery I could get.
Yeah. What have I been through lockdown? How are you coping?
Lockdown has been quite difficult, especially given my past experiences where isolation is actually one of my triggers. And I think during lockdown I just, you know, had eagle eye focus on the things that made me feel good, i.e. Yeah. Running, working out indoors, finding new and interesting challenges.
Yeah.
None of which I was particularly good at, but it was, you know, good to give it a go.
Yeah, absolutely. And are you mentioned you're training to be a PT. Are you still going through that process?
Yes, I'm still going through that process. Of course, that process was halted and delayed during lockdown, but now things are back opening, restrictions are relaxing. I'm able to continue with my studies.
Great. Let's start, I guess, with... Where did you grow up?
Where did I grow up? Sorry.
Yes. Yeah. Where did you grow up?
It's a difficult question to answer because I was moved around a lot as a child.
Right, okay.
I was born in Croydon, so South London.
Yeah.
I was in New Addington with my family for a while, and then it was Orpington to get away. And then yeah. I was put into foster care, so I dotted around.
Yeah.
Okay. I kind of circled London throughout my life.
Okay. Oh, wow. But how old were you when you were kind of left your father? What age were you there?
I was taken into foster care at the age of 11.
Yeah.
But I think I left part of my family much earlier than that because there were obvious signs of, you know, neglect and trauma, and I was, you know, doing what any child does in that situation, and it's lashing out because no one can see or hear what's going on. So it's like a textbook reaction to something.
Yeah. Okay.
Like that. Yeah.
And do you sort of know when you started suffering from sort of this treatment? Do you have recollections of it, or is it kind of something you block out of your mind?
A little bit of both. I've done a lot of internal work with myself, especially through therapy, counselling, that sort of stuff. So there are stuff that I do block out that I don't remember, or I just choose not to remember. But I can remember quite a lot, and a lot of the time it is just sort of like key points, like the worst of it. And it goes back to as far as I can remember. So I believe that there are things that, you know, the neglect was much longer than what my memory can go back to.
And obviously you were a child then. Can you remember how you felt? Do you remember anything about kind of the way you felt during those early years?
Quiet would be the first word that comes to mind. You know, you were seen and not heard. You know, you had to be quiet, stay away, you know, don't ask for anything. That's the main thing that I can think of. Because when I look back and I try and put myself in that headspace, it is all just very quiet because that was safe. Quiet meant, you know, you were going to be okay.
And that stage of the day, you moved to foster care. How was that being taken away from you? What was your reaction to that?
I think initially it was very upsetting because I was very confused. I didn't know what was going on. I literally just went to school one day. I was sitting in assembly and a head teacher came in and pulled me out and took me to her office. I'm very confused. No one's told me, you know, I've gone into the office. There's social services, a police officer. And I think I knew when I walked in the room something was wrong, and I, you know, got quite anxious. I remember this quite clearly. And they gave me the phone, which I, you know, answered, and it was my mum crying on the other end because she was also in trouble because we had a very childish argument the night before, and I had red marks around my neck from a struggle we had. And that was initially where the school, you know, called social services. I don't think the plan was to ever keep me away from my mum. I think they put me into foster care for like 2 weeks and they put me back in the care of my mum. But it just wasn't working. You know, we weren't getting along. She didn't know what happened. And it was kind of like I couldn't explain it to her. So I was lashing out. You don't understand, you know.
What is your relationship like with your mum now then?
I think when I turned 18, 19, I realised that if I just kept my mouth shut, you know, and I didn't question everything she said, you know, like she needs to believe that she played a good part in my upbringing and, you know, she needs to tell herself this. And I didn't realise that for a very long time. And every time she's saying something like, oh, you know, I raised you to be a strong, independent woman, and I question that. I'm bursting her bubble, and therefore we're arguing. Yeah, and neither of us feel good. So I realised if I just kept my mouth shut, I could actually maintain a relationship with my mum. So we do have a good relationship now, but only because, you know, I let her tell herself whatever she needs to in order to keep thriving.
That's quite a difficult thing to come to a realization of. Was that therapy? Did that help? Or did you just sort of decide to be the bigger person?
Honestly, I think it's because I was tired of the arguing. You know, I wanted so desperately to have a relationship with my mum, who's I deemed like the only family member I have. Because the rest of them, you know, I've separated myself from and I avoid like the plague. You know, she was the lesser of two evils, if that makes sense.
And what about your relationship with your dad?
My father wasn't around, as far as I'm aware. So I've never met him. I do know he was a bit of a troublemaker. I think when I was 16, social services gave me a bunch of paperwork from my childhood that I could read through in the hopes of answering some questions I had about the stuff I don't remember. And when I was just a baby, he went to prison I think for 6 counts of armed robbery. So that would be a good thing he wasn't around.
Yeah, absolutely. So then into aftercare. It's initially a short term thing. How long did that kind of feeling of not being settled go on in your life?
A long time. I think I still struggle with that just a little bit. Because initially it was 2 weeks. They took me away.
Yeah.
And then they gave me back. And of course, things weren't working at home. I wasn't safe. And I was still so angry and confused about everything that had happened to me that I just couldn't really express to anyone. So that meant no one knew and no one could help. And it was just like this cycle of struggle for not only me, but, you know, everyone around me. But they took me back into foster care after that. And I remember just being very quiet where I wouldn't talk to the people I was staying with. Yeah. You know, I would just do as I was told because that was how I learned to be safe.
Yeah.
You know, to be quiet, do as you're told, and don't argue.
Yeah.
You know, they put me into, like, a care home with a bunch of other children in the same situation as myself. And they put me in there for, I think, just over a year. They tried home again, but within a matter of weeks, I was back in.
Yeah.
They just kept trying to put me back with my mum, like, several times. And, you know, I think they realised when it weren't working, they put me into one last placement where I finally felt like I could, you know, live there. Because during foster care, I was running away because I didn't feel comfortable in someone else's house, you know, having no privacy, not knowing who these people are.
Yeah. Where were you running to? Where were you running to when you ran away?
I would run away to hang out with some people I called my friends, but it was very much just people who took drugs, drank, you know, go to hostels, get into trouble. But I felt more at home in a situation like that than I did in any placement that social services put me.
How bad did I get it? How bad did the drug dealer, did you touch the drugs yourself?
Yes.
How bad was that? How bad did that get?
Well, at first I thought it was fun. It was interesting, you know, seeing pretty lights and, you know, your imagination escaping you. But it got to the point where I would have to have it, would take it, and then it would make me feel physically sick.
Right, okay.
But I would
continue. You must have
been a teenager. Yeah, so I started quite young. I was around about 12 when I first took drugs, but it was just cannabis at the time.
Yeah.
But it, of course, progressed into Class A drugs. And I kept that string going for a very long time.
And then how did you come into contact with drugs?
It would have been family members and their friends. You know, I don't want to mention names. They used to think it was cool or funny in order to get someone my age drunk or high. You know, they would find that rather amusing. You know, I remember the first time I ever took a puff on a cigarette. I was quite scared. I remember not wanting to do it. And they turned and said, if I didn't, they would punch me. Oh. So, of course, me, first time ever, took a puff on this cigarette and, of course, coughed my lungs up.
Yeah.
It wasn't very pleasant.
Yeah.
So that's kind of how it really started. You know, they would have me around where they did these things and they would have me roll their, you know, joints and cigarettes for them.
Really? Oh,
yeah.
God. And obviously, I guess at that age, you don't really know what's wrong and what's right.
It took me a long time.
So even then, at the end of when you set it up, okay, were you still dabbling in this sort of thing? Were you still involved in alcohol and drugs?
I was, yes. friends that I was hanging around with were part of that scene. So I always had access to it. And being a young female, you know, there would be people who would, you know, try and take advantage of that and would, you know, offer it to me. You know, so it was like through drugs, I did put myself into some very vulnerable situations. Probably lucky to get out, you know, unscathed.
And obviously at age 18, I guess then you're free to go and live your life. What happened to you then? What was there?
So at 18, I did start to calm down. You know, glotzes wasn't a thing anymore. I was still, you know, drinking and smoking cannabis. But the hard stuff was in the past. Not that I wouldn't have taken it if I had access to it. But I sort of removed myself from the people I was around. So that made it a lot easier for me to separate myself from the drugs.
Yeah, okay. For the most part.
You know, I was in a fairly settled placement at the time. I wanted to move out on my own. So it was kind of like I had this idea of independence, moving to my own place, which of course did happen, and I'm still living in the same place now. But when I was 18, I just sort of learned a lot about myself because I wasn't drowning everything out as much. You know, I was in college at the time. I started a new job at Travelodge. And yeah, things were okay at that age.
Okay. So you're still able to get a... With all this going on in the background, you're still able to put yourself through school and get yourself an education. It's pretty admirable, really.
I'm not very good at doing that. And I think the more I was around those friends who were doing nothing but taking drugs and getting into trouble, I was sort of like impressionable, where I was sort of slipping into the same patterns as they were. And then constantly being moved around. You know, I was being moved to places where I couldn't necessarily go see my friends that often, or I was having my phone taken away from me, which meant I couldn't find out where they were, or I wasn't given any money, so I couldn't travel to them. So, at the time, of course, I was very unhappy about it, because, you know, I was having problems. I didn't like to be separated from my friends, and I honestly felt like I was being imprisoned a lot of the time. Because I didn't feel, you know, comfortable in someone else's house. You know, I just wanted to be around people I called my friends.
Yeah, so essentially you're being punished for the faults of others. So at that point you moved to a more secure place, got your job. Were you still drinking, and what did that look like? Do you think you were sort of dependent on alcohol at that stage?
I was, yes, because I had less access to drugs, but have access to alcohol, my alcohol consumption went way up because it's fairly cheap, you can get it anywhere. I'm old enough to buy it, so I don't have to ask someone. And that obviously caused a lot of problems for myself, not only health wise, but also I would have these blackouts where I don't remember a thing, but I'm still walking and talking and still somehow putting myself into, again, very vulnerable situations where it's very easy to be taken advantage of.
Were you living alone? Did you have a partner?
I was living alone, but I was in a relationship at the time. It wasn't great. We used to argue a lot. It was very manipulative and childish, very unhealthy.
How much were you both drinking at times?
He was more of a smoker, and I was the drinker, so we chose a different poisons, and I think I just got sick of the arguing eventually, and I left, and I was on my own for a while before I decided to try again.
So how did the next sort of period play out? You know, you eventually found yourself in another relationship, and how did that materialise?
Well, I'd calmed down with the drinking at that point, and more of a smoker myself. So that's actually how I met my partner at 21.
Was he the same age as you, was he?
Yes, he was the same age as me, yeah. And things were good for the first 4 months, so I thought. Now looking back, I realised that we met up one day at mine. We played cards, you know, your typical, we're bored, we'll find something to do type of stuff. And then he just never left. Looking back, I realised that was the biggest of all red flags. At the time, I quite liked it. You know, I had someone around, someone who wanted to be around. But of course, it turned sour quite quickly.
Yeah. Wow. So, with the smoking, why? The hard question, but why do you think you were? What did the drink and the smoke provide you? What were you looking for in those things?
The alcohol and the drugs provided me with a distraction. I didn't have to think about, you know, how horrible I felt or have the flashbacks from previous traumatic experiences. And it also helped me ignore the. It's like when you go through an experience, a traumatic experience as a child, you pick up these habits as an adult, you know, the not being able to maintain healthy relationships and, you know, not feeling safe around people. So you become a people pleaser to keep, you know, yourself safe. Just little things like this that made me. I re-victimized myself.
Right,
by following those patterns. And when I was taking drugs and drinking, it wasn't about that. It was just about getting off my head with my friends, potentially having a giggle and completely ignoring everything. Of course, that wasn't sustainable and extremely unhealthy. When I look back to think of how many drugs I took, what situations I was in, I'm lucky to be alive, honestly. Wow.
And do you think sort of then, with this relationship, do you think because of, you talk about your victimisation, do you think you were kind of let it unfold because, or let him stay there because, I guess you were trying to please him?
Yeah, it was also, he lived at home with his mum and his dad and his sister, and it was like this whole family dynamic that I have never had, but I've always wanted. So, of course, when he introduced me to his family, I felt very welcome and at home. And I think that's another reason why I stayed and put up with the abuse as long as I did. Although, when we would stay at his parents' house, the abuse was so severe. There was one thing I did enjoy, and that was early morning coffees in the kitchen with his mum and his nan. You know, just having a chat. That was their little routine that I saw. You know, got into, and that was like my favourite part of all of that. You know, and I just, I didn't want to let that go, so I think that was another reason why I held on as long as I did.
How long did you hold on?
2 years.
Right, okay.
Yeah,
and
it was.
Jeez. And so, what ways did the abuse manifest itself?
The abuse sort of started around month four. That's when it really started to show, but it was very subtle and it was small things here and there, things that you just shove off and go, oh, this is just insecure, I can fix this, you know? Oh, he's worried, that means he cares, you know, like just little things like this, but it of course progressed very quickly where it was just another thing, another rule that I had to abide by, you know, not going anywhere by myself. And before I knew it, I was a prisoner in my own house.
Wow.
You know, I didn't have access to my phone. I was isolated off from everyone that I knew to the point where I was actually losing friends.
So you realised you're trapped then. How long did you live with this realisation?
Yeah, you know, like although it took months to happen, it kind of happened so quickly. I didn't see it happen until it was too late, and then I realised just what a pickle I've got myself into.
Yeah. So obviously you realise that. How long were you then living in a situation where you couldn't get out? And you were good?
I'd say a little over a year, because the other year I spent that time trying to get away. You know, my eyes were open. I could see what was happening. I knew I was so unhappy. It also doesn't help. I actually found out I was pregnant because I wasn't allowed to go anywhere by myself. I couldn't go to the GP for, contraception or anything like that, and saying no wasn't an option. You know, because that was bad. I would get punished in some way for that, whether it be physical or emotional or abuse. You know, and it would go on for as long as I said, just given what it wanted, although it was never enough to spare me from any abuse.
Right.
So, of course, I did end up pregnant from that. But I had no one to talk to. I couldn't tell anyone. I tried to tell my mum, but she just, she didn't say anything to me. And I think that's because she didn't know what to say. And, you know, that kind of left me feeling like I'm on my own.
Yeah.
I told him that I was pregnant, and things escalated a huge amount from there where, despite that I was never allowed to go anywhere by myself, not even to the toilet. Yes, it was that severe. You know, if I wasn't in the room when he woke up in the morning, I was doing something, someone else. And of course, when I told him that I was pregnant, he was like, oh, well, it's not mine.
What?
Yeah, you know, he would come up with these ludicrous lies, you know, like I was cheating on him. So I would say, well, how? I'm 24/7. You know, I can't even go to the bathroom to myself. How is it that I am doing this? His answer was that I'm drugging him, tying him up at night, sneaking out the house, doing all this, you know, adultery stuff, coming home, undoing everything. And that was his reasoning, because that was the only way me doing his, you know, lies was possible. It's so insane. Screwing me up, tying knots in my head, where I'm constantly having to explain reality to someone, only to have it dismissed. And of course, I was extremely malnourished. I could only eat when he ate. I wasn't sleeping because he would wake me up whenever he wanted to throughout the night, whether it be to roll him a cigarette or get him a drink or make him something to eat. You know, sometimes he would just wake me up. You know, wake me up and say, oh, you're pouting in your sleep. You must be dreaming of someone else. You're not allowed to sleep tonight. You know, things like that. So I wasn't in a good position in order to, you know, carry or even have this child. So, of course, I wanted to see a GP, someone I could talk to, discuss my concerns, you know, to really figure out what was going on. But he decided that he was going to pick a clinic for me to go to, which was a couple of hours from home. And we went there, but he was like a dog on a bone the entire way. And I'm sat there on a bus, and he's just sitting there whispering these horrible things to me the whole time. And I feel like I was led like a lamb to slaughter. You know, they could have... You know, the devil could have sat there in front of me and asked me to sign my soul away, and I would have done it, not knowing what I was doing. And of course, I decided that I was going to terminate said pregnancy, because otherwise I was going to be stuck with him. And he was saying that he was going to take it off of me, you know, that I would never see him if I lived. You know, things like that. He was getting a bunch of knives out and asking me which to pick one that he was going to stab me with. You know, he would make these imaginary phone calls saying that he was going to get someone with a van to bury me on top of a hill. You know, just horrible things like this. And it was so constant. I was just, I didn't really feel like I had a choice. I had no one giving me any other alternative or even help or advice, you know. I was very lost and alone.
Yeah.
So I opted to terminate, which it went wrong. Procedure went horribly wrong, and I was dying blood poisoning for a few months.
So were you in hospital?
I went to the clinic where I had this operation. It went horribly wrong because on the day they said you can go for it a week and you can leave in an hour, or we can put you to sleep and you'll leave within 3 hours. And at this point, with him biting down on my neck, you know, verbally, I just wanted to go home, crawl up into a ball and pretend none of this was happening. I didn't exist. So I agreed to go for it away, just so that I could go home sooner. But I had no idea what I was getting myself in for. You know, this is something I still have night terrors about. You know, it scares the hell out of me, and I wouldn't recommend it to anyone. And I have a deep sympathy for anyone who has gone through anything like this. But I think because it was so excruciating and painful, they stopped before it was finished, which then meant I was, you know, suffering of blood poisoning. And I got taken to the hospital a month, was it 2 months later? A month and a bit later, where I had to have the procedure again in order to spare my life. And he was still around at the point. And I spent the night in the hospital where obviously he couldn't stay with me, so it was my first night away from him for a very long time, and I was quite scared, crying all night. And the next day, when I came out of surgery for the second time, I'm laying there in the bed. My mum was also in the room, and she was accusing me of sleeping with someone in the hospital that night because he wasn't around. It's just I was dying. Surgery, and this is what you're thinking of, and that's just how insane it was.
So how did you get out of the situation? What enabled you to leave in the end?
I think it was the loss of my baby. I think I realised that there was nothing more he could do to hurt me. Like, he could kill me, yes, but then the pain would stop. You know, there's nothing more he could possibly do to me that will be any worse than what I just went through. Because I didn't know what I was doing. If I knew then what I knew now, you know, I would have my baby and he would be in prison. Because another thing I couldn't do during that time was call the police and ask them. So, of course, when I had this realization, I was getting him out of the house and kicking him out of the house. He would try and post things in the letterbox so that I'd have to give it back to him, you know, see or things like that, and he'll just get his foot in the door. But I'd learnt my lesson, it wasn't happening anymore. So he would follow me to places where he knew I would go, either GP or I took like a weekend job at a local shop, you know, just helping them with cash and carry and sorting out the shelves. And he would follow me there and stay there day. The moment I got in, the moment I left. And where I live, the house conversion, so I'm on the top floor of my house. And the double-decker bus on the main road is level with my living room window. So he would go back and forth on that bus to have a look through my window to make sure that I was home, to make sure I was home alone. And he would constantly call me and text me with all these absurd lies and abusive behaviour. And that happened every day, hundreds of times a day. And I realised at this point that he had calmed down with the coming around, you know, following me around. He was just targeting me online. And because I was ignoring him, which is very difficult to do, but I was ignoring him. So what he did is he wrote the names of everyone I had on Facebook and sent them to me. and then individually sent all of these people a very horrible, disgusting, foul message to each of the people I had on Facebook about me. Horrible stuff that I'd rather not repeat. But slowly but surely I had to remove all of these people. You know, so what he was trying to do was isolate me further to make sure that none of these people were actually talking to me. So if he could say some horrible thing, they wouldn't want to talk to me either. You know, and the text messages were so constant, I'm pretty sure he didn't take a break to use the bathroom or to eat. It was like, I had to put my phone on silent because of how constant the text messages were. And it got to the point where I went to the police. And I told them, I said, look, this is what's happening. I needed to stop. So I gave them my phone. They downloaded the text messages. And the very same day, they told me and said, we have everything we need to make an arrest. And they arrested him. They took him to court. They had more than enough evidence. So I didn't have to, you know, see him again after that. And they gave me a 3-year restraining order where he couldn't contact me directly or indirectly.
Great. Has he stuck to that, though? Has there been any discretion?
He did stick to the restraining order, as far as I know.
Yeah.
Of course, that has ended now. You know, I do get a lot of random friend requests or random messages, but unless I know you, I'm not answering. So there's still a little bit of, like, caution there for myself.
What was life like after? I mean, you've been through so much. Like, how could you then? Were you able to kind of find any normality in your life?
Sadly not. When I got the restraining order initially, I could still hear my phone going off. You know, like, it was like this, I'd been psychologically conditioned to hear it, you know, like a car would go past and I would hear my phone go off. Or, you know, someone would say something and I would hear my phone go off, you know, and it's just like this weird internal battle that I was facing. And I think it was a lot harder when he was gone, because I was just like, what do I do now? Because when he was around, all I had to worry about was doing what he told me to. To make the abuse a little less each day. You know, I just had to do what I was told. It was, dare I say it, a very simple, in comparison to, oh, I'm in debt, I now need to fix these bills, I need to talk to this person, I need to make a phone call, I need to get shopping in, like, how do I'd completely forgotten how to function on my own. You know, talking to people was scary. It was very difficult, and I fell into like a hole where I was now isolating myself off from the world, and I was so scared of everything. Like, my door would go off, and you'd think I was wanted for murder the way I react. You know, I'm just like so scared. You know, my windows and doors always have to be locked. My curtains haven't been opened. You know, it's very like I'm trying to make myself feel safe, but it was a very difficult thing to maintain.
So how did that change it? What made the change?
I'm not entirely sure. I think I was just stagnant in the same place for so long, and I just felt like something's got to give. You know, I shouldn't. Why can't I enjoy my life? Why can't I be happy? So I started seeking help. You know, from Oxley, Mind, you know, a few mental health organisations that, you know, are supposed to support people like myself. You know, and it was a battle asking for help, you know, and receiving it. It took a long time, but I went through a therapy programme that I didn't really feel like I could get anything from, or I couldn't take anything from it.
Yeah.
Because I already feel like I have an understanding of psychology and, you know, the decisions we make and the emotions we have and where they come from, and so on. But it didn't help me understand that, although that is only step one. Later, they suggested women's aid, which is a charity that helps women such as myself. But I didn't think they would help me because I already got myself out. I'm just struggling with the aftermath. But they did take me on, and I joined a six-week program with them. And it was interesting, to say the least, because it was very difficult for me to leave the house, to travel, and then sit into a room with a bunch of people I didn't know and even have these conversations with. But I stuck it out, followed through with the program. And I guess at the end, what I took away from it was that I'm not crazy. You know, I do know what I see, what I feel, what I hear. You know, I can trust my instincts and intuition, which I had been systematically conditioned to doubt everything that I knew by him. So that was, I think, a very important lesson to learn. And of course, they, at the end, said, oh, would you like help getting fit? We can refer you to another organisation. I was like, in a very optimistic 5 minutes. Which usually I would have said no, I just want to go home and hide. Yeah. They said yes. And they introduced me to the woman coach at the running charity. We had a little chat, and we agreed to meet up to go for a run. And I don't know why I agreed to it, but I'm so glad I did. Because it was honestly the start of, you know, unraveling the chains I'd locked myself in. You know, the start of my freedom.
Great. So she started running with a coach there. How did that progress then? What did that? Did you love it to start with?
So on the first run, I hated it. I was overweight, an on and off smoker at the time.
Yeah.
And it was so difficult. You know, I don't even think we made it a kilometer.
Yeah.
And I think the first like 10, 15 seconds, I was so out of breath.
Yeah.
I felt like my heart was just going to stop beating. We ran, walked that kilometre, but I did it despite the fact that it was so uncomfortable, almost painful.
Yeah.
I suffered for it for a few days afterwards.
Yeah.
You know, like the leg pain. But it felt good in order to exhaust myself in such a way, strangely enough. So I agreed to do it again the next week. And those were like big stepping stones, you know, because it was just a one-to-one.
Yeah.
So I sort of like felt supported and safe in that environment to keep going back. And I think the next step, when I was up to 3 kilometres, or 4 I think at the time, I joined the mixed group of men and women.
Yeah.
And other. And that was another big stepping stone. For me, to feel safe in, you know, a much larger group. But the people were so nice, so welcoming, so supportive, so chatty. I don't think there was a way I could have felt unsafe. I think it's like the anxiety build up on the way there, given my past experiences. And then when you're actually in that situation, it's hard to see these wonderful people in that light.
So
it just became a habit. It's like it was the best part of my week, you know, like being at home, isolated off. I couldn't wait until, you know, the group run where I could have a horrible journey there, but a wonderful time, you know, and again on the tube to come back, because traveling was still quite difficult for me to do, you know, having like anxiety attacks with so many people. The tube was terrible, but I was willing to go through that uncomfortability. Wondrous people and go sweat for half an hour.
Great. How many years ago was that then?
I have been with the running charity 3 years now.
Great. Yeah, and you're still going to the groups?
Absolutely, yeah. I'm not going anywhere.
Yeah, great. And then how big is the group now? Is it quite a big group of people? What sort of people come along to the group?
Because they take referrals in, young people referrals from, you know, hostels, homeless shelters, you know, other charities, and also through someone who knows, you know, if you're vulnerable experiencing homelessness or, you know, domestic abuse, abuse background, and you know, the running charity can help, they will, you know, so it's quite a large, diverse group, which I think is one of the amazing things about it. And yeah, of course, during lockdown, the group has thinned a little bit, but that's to be expected as things are still reopening. You know, the groups are coming out of their shells again.
Great. So you started with the K. Do you guys now, how's that progressed? Do you guys now run events and challenges together?
We do, yes. We can run races of anywhere from 5 kilometres to half marathons. I haven't run my first marathon yet. That will come in October this year. And I've had the running training support throughout this, and, you know, internally grateful. Marathon training is slow at the moment, but it will improve when I run. Having some IT band issues, which is typical when you're training for an event.
Great, we'll have to have a look out for you then at London. So, presumably, be wearing the running charity vest.
Absolutely, yeah. I would wear one every day if I could. You know, not really having anyone supportive and that safe, and someone I can believe in. You know, they restored my faith in humanity. So, they're on a very high pedestal for me. Yeah.
I've been keeping you a long time. I'm not sure how long we've been running. My watch actually turned off. So I'm not actually sure how far we've gone. But we've done a decent one. I should probably let you go. It's been really lovely to chat.
And you.
Good luck with the London Marathon.
Thank you.
Great stuff.